Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 1st. 2022, and I'm delighted to have as a guest on this podcast for the New Books Network, Michael Gora of Smith College, who has written a wonderful book about William Faulkner and his relationship, his writing relationship, actually his personal relationship as well, with the Civil War. The book is called, published by Norton, the imprint is Liverlight. It's called The Saddest Words, William Faulkner's Civil War. It was published at the end of last year, 2021. So let's not bury the lead, Michael. What are the saddest words? Everyone wants to know what the saddest words that Faulkner is talking about.
Okay, there are two of them. And the idea comes up in The Sound of the Fury. The father of the family at the heart of that novel of Compson's, Mr. Compson says to his son, Quentin, that was is the saddest word of all, was. The past tense of is, because when something is was, it's over, it's finished, it can't be changed, you can't do anything about it. And Quentin thinks to himself, he thinks, no, there's a sadder word, and that's again. Again is sadder than was because what again implies is that things go on repeating themselves. Even if they are in the past, even if they have become was, they go on repeating in that you don't get over them. You may not be able to fix or change them, but you don't get over them. They have the capacity to hurt you again and again and again. And that's what is happening in this family, where the various traumas and difficulties and pains of family life, which are mostly clustered around Quentin's sister, Candace or Caddy, those things are ever recurring. They are again, even though there also was. And so those are the saddest words, was and again. And what I do is move out from that novel to think about those words in the context of Southern history. Faulkner had a sense that Faulkner liked the present tense. He liked to write in the present tense, which implied that things were not yet done. They were not yet finished. But he also knew that things were often over, that they were finished, they were unchanged. And I use those two words as a way to think about the history of the South, and especially of the white South, since the Civil War. People who are constantly replaying a history that they can neither change nor get over, and so they're sort of frozen into their past, into a kind of moral stasis that has left that South in many ways a kind of wasteland.
Well, you write quite a bit about the, I guess you would call it, the historiography of the war, and I don't think it's quite right to say that the South was engaged in a revisionist history. It was something different than a revisionist history. They wanted it a way to distort or change the whole idea of the war itself, what it was about, so that you actually had people denying that it was about slavery.
Right. No, it's not. Sorry, it's not just a revisionist history. It's a revanchist history. It's beyond revisionism. It's denying that the war was about what people at the time all said it was about. People in 1860 and 61, they all said and they knew that the war was about slavery. It's after the South is lost and after the South has managed in 1876 to defeat Reconstruction, to turn that back, they begin to say, well, no, it wasn't about slavery. It was a question of principle. It was a constitutional issue, or maybe it was about the tariff, or all kinds of things like that. They find ways to deny what everybody at the moment knew the war was about. You can find soldiers on both sides saying, you know, who know, absolutely know that the war is about slavery as they're fighting it. What happens after the war is people, I think, in many ways, they're embarrassed, ashamed to say, to admit that it was about slavery. They're embarrassed about the fact of slavery. And so they're trying to find high-minded justifications for what has happened, high-minded justifications that they can pass on to their children, perhaps, as a way of avoiding a sense of guilt, that to enable them to think well of that ancestral past. Also, of course, for political advantage in the United States at the end of the 19th century. If you can pretend that the war is about slavery, what was about slavery, then you can pretend that there's nothing really wrong with the way that that the White South is treating the Black South.
So this gave the South a chance to save face, I guess is the phrase.
To what, I'm sorry?
To save face.
To save face, but saving face, of course, becomes a power play. Mm-hmm. And then as part of that power play, you get all the Confederate monuments being erected around 1900, 1910, which in many ways are designed to let the Black South know who's in charge again.
Well, in your book, you write at some length about the compromise that historians, in a way, came to. They presented a compromise so that both the North and the South could get on with things and not actually be stuck in debating the real merits of the Civil War.
Right. It's a compromise not just with historians, but also with politicians, and with a compromise between the White South and the White North, to pretend that they don't know what they know, that the war was about slavery, to say that it's about principle. And then in the early years of, in the 1920s, you have a different kind of historian who says that, well, the war was really about large impersonal economic forces. It was about the transition to an industrial economy away from an agricultural economy. It was about the growth and the rise of sophisticated instruments of modern capitalism, and individual people and choices and political the sort of the ebb and flow of daily politics really didn't have much to do with it at all. That this war was just a kind of inevitability. That was what was called the progressive school of politics, associated with Charles and Mary Beard, among others. But that had the effect of downplaying the importance of slavery as well. It's really in the post-World War II period that professional historians began to look more closely at the role of slavery in the bringing about of the Civil War. You know, this goes back to the work of Allan Nevins, though of course W.E.B. Du Bois had been working on those lines in the 1930s. It's the professional historians slowly forge a consensus about the importance of slavery to the war, but it takes an awful long time for that to trickle down, into high school texts, to trickle down into popular awareness, Remember that many of the southern states had textbook commissions that held that the South's secession had to be presented in a positive light. And so you know, I had a student around 2000 who'd gone to a private school in New Orleans who told me that she was surprised to learn that the Civil War was about slavery because that was not what she'd been taught in high school. This was an old line sort of fancy traditional private school. It was not a modern Sega Academy. But yes, it was. She was surprised to learn that. As when she learned that, she was then eager to learn more and wanted to write about that. And she had a sense that her teachers had in effect lied to her. But that was still going on. Certainly, when I was in high school, when you were in high school, we weren't taught that slavery was what the Civil War was about. It was about states' rights.
That's right. That's the great phrase that came out of the discussion: states' rights. So, I want to bring you back though to what you wrote in your book, and what Faulkner wrote in his books. And I thought I had a really clever way of describing, as a way of an introduction, what happens here, saying that this is a meditation by you on Faulkner's meditation on the Civil War. But there, the more I thought about it, I don't think it really fits that it's a meditation by Faulkner, because it's not really intentional, if I understand your book correctly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have this wonderful description on in the book, where you talk about how he would say things in public, he would write things that were clearly racist, but that when it came to confronting that blank, naked page, something in him was triggered to be honest, to deal with the truth, and something came out that was different. So it wasn't really an intentional act on his part. It was something that he couldn't help himself from doing, that is, writing about race relations. So you're
right.
I
think that's true. You know,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
If we're thinking about intentional acts, we might think of Robert Penn Warren as somebody who is consciously wrestling with and meditating on and trying to come to terms with that past in his essays as well as in a book like All the King's Men. But Faulkner, yes, when Faulkner is faced with that naked fictional page, he somehow becomes a different person than he is when he's going about as an everyday citizen, as a social being in Mississippi in those decades. You know, in ordinary everyday life, there's not a lot that separates Faulkner from many of the other white people of his time and class. But when that fictional page is there, there's something in him that's compelled or forced or it's, and I'm not even certain it's entirely willed to look more closely at his world, at his society than he would have just as an ordinary social being. I think it's one of the mysteries of art. I don't think this is unique to Faulkner. I think it happens with most great writers that you know, in some ways in the act of writing, they find, this is an old line, but it's Matthew Arnold's line, they find their best selves. They find their best selves. And nowadays, I think a lot of us have trouble with that idea. We want there to be a kind of seamlessness between the person and the artist, that what the artist is judged by the worst things the person has said, never the other way around. But we want there to be seamlessness, a wholeness, as if there is no split. I think here of a line that the philosopher Kant said. He said, "Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made." Everybody's bent. Everybody has flaws. Some people fight them. Faulkner, when he's writing fiction, fought them. I think that writing fiction made him better than he was, and better than he was in you know, civilian life, as it were. And then at times later in his life, even as sometimes he was saying really regrettable things, he would also try to do good things. I mean, he did try to organize other people in his town against the citizens' councils, which were called the, you know, the Uptown Klan that gained a lot of power in Mississippi after Brown v. Board of Education. Faulkner, you know, didn't want that. He wanted there to be a future, and he didn't want Mississippi's future to be the same as its past.
I want to ask you about the nature of your own meditation as it appears in the book. But before I do that, I want to just mention that it was a few months ago I reread All the King's Men and was just stunned. I guess I was stunned the last time I read it also, but I'm just stunned by how good that book is. What do you think of the book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's the kind of book you finish and say, my God, if I could write just one page.
It's about 10 or 15 years
since I've
looked at
it. The way that Robert Penn Warren wrote that book, I would be delighted.
It's, I think, an extraordinary
happily go to my grades. Stunning how good it is.
Maybe nothing in it is quite as good as the very beginning. The very beginning, that drive through rural Louisiana and the first meeting with the Huey Long character, and the discovery of this person who has not yet become who he's going to become. A book that shows how somebody who sets out to be an admirable person becomes increasingly megalomaniac, maybe evil, certainly dangerous. It's a magnificent book.
Did he write anything that came close to being as good as that? Anything else? I've only read a few other things by him and never was particularly impressed.
Yeah. You know, I've haven't read any of his other fiction, honestly.
Oh, okay.
I've read his book on the legacy of the Civil War. It's a long essay. Mm-hmm. I've read his book on integration, another long essay. I think those are important books, and the writing in them is beautiful and meditative and powerful, and they still have the capacity to make you think. He wrote wonderful critical essays. I don't know about his other fiction. I keep on hearing how marvelous his poetry is, but I'm not a poetry person. So.
Yeah. All right. So back to this meditation that you engage in. You throw everything at this meditation. You travel everywhere. You go and see the battlefields. You go to Mississippi. You go to Oxford. You spend all this time talking to people. You've read everything, it seems like, when it comes to both histories of the war and interpretations of what's happened to the South in the last 150 years. How in the world did you just threw yourself into this project, it seems? Is that a fair statement?
I guess it is. You know, I had there was a kind of run up to it, in that before I thought of the project, I'd done a Norton critical edition of As I Lay Dying, and that had gotten me to reread a lot of Faulkner and to start to learn my way around Faulkner criticism. And then as I was working up historical background for that novel, I started to learn some things about agriculture in Mississippi, about social structure, and so on. As I started to think that I might want to write at greater length about Faulkner, and this was in 2010, 2011, the way I learn new things is by teaching them. So I came up with two courses that would show me what this material was. And I got the idea for this, as I say in the introduction, on a sabbatical year that I was spending in Paris, when in the time when I wasn't writing or going out for dinner, I did a lot of historical reading on the Civil War. That became the pleasure reading I was doing that year. I just something that you're motivating me to take up that subject. I think it was partly because I was in 2010, and I was disturbed by the congressional elections that year and by the kind of rhetoric I was hearing, reading in the newspaper about people claiming states' rights issues over certain things. This is when somebody like Ted Cruz began his rise. I was thinking a lot about America that year as I was living abroad. And I thought I wanted to learn more about the war, but I was also, had been writing a little bit about Faulkner, and I started to put those two things together. And so, as I said, the way that I learn things is by teaching them. So I came up with a course on Faulkner that would, where I would read, say, 8 novels with my students, and I would be learning all the criticism and more critical background. And then I came up with a course called Reading the Civil War, which is more of a history course than a literature course, but where we looked at a lot of documentary sources about the war. And I used the Library of America volumes on the Civil War as seen by those who lived it, which collected documents year by year going through the war, speeches and reports on battles and letters and diaries and all kinds of things. I read some in the historiography. I read some of the great diaries that came out of the war, all kinds of things like that. And I put together a course that would, take my students through that, again, mostly working with documentary sources, so they learned how to read primary materials. And then, a couple of other things that would provide them with background. We looked at, say, Bruce Catton's account of Pickett's charge in his History of the Army of the Potomac. And then we matched it with Shelby Foote's account of Pickett's charge from his trilogy. And what that let me do is to show my students that even historical writing has a point of view. Students often think the history is objective, but by using these two different accounts of the same thing, I would show, the history has a point of view. Catton positions himself behind the wall towards which the Confederates are marching, and Foote positions himself just in the choices of historical actors he chooses to follow. He positions himself with the marching Confederates. Students really, really liked that assignment, and I think it worked well. So anyway, that's part of how I learned all this material, and then I read a lot of other fiction too.
But when did you decide you had to go?
I guess it was a lot of work. Oh, what made me decide to go to these places? Yeah.
Some of the best parts of your book are when you're describing these battles.
Yeah. Yeah,
describing what you're seeing now, imagining what it was like 150 years ago.
Right. Okay. So the answer to that goes back in some ways to the book I wrote before this one, which is a book about Henry James called Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. In the book before that, I had done a little bit of travel writing. I'd written a travel book about Germany, in which I used the German novels I was reading as a kind of guide to the places I was visiting. What I did with the James book was I included descriptions of the places where he lived while he was writing Portrait of a Lady. I included accounts of the places where he set the novel. And sometimes, visiting them and describing my visits there writing as a travel writer in those scenes. And one of the things that allowed me to do was to talk about the difference between, say, a documentary reality, an actual place, and the imaginative use that James made of it. It also allowed me, when I'm talking about the places that he visited or the places where he wrote, to, in effect, make him a character and use that to animate my own writing. I found that I wanted to find a way, and this was true of the James book, and I guess the Faulkner book did it as well. I wanted to find a way to turn criticism, to turn literary criticism into a kind of storytelling. And I wanted to do that because, you know, very few people read literary criticism. Very few people read criticism, I think not just because the language of literary theory has gotten so difficult, but they read it, they don't read it because what we really want to read are stories. I think biography tells stories, and it draws many more readers than most works of literary criticism. So I was looking for a way to try to turn criticism into a narrative, into a story. And I found that by intercutting passages of analysis, where I'm looking closely at, say, a given novel or a section of a novel, by intercutting that with an account of the writer's life, with accounts of my own attempts to find out about the writer's life and about the work and to understand them, that I could create a kind of narrative engine that would let the book go forward as if it were a kind of story, and that people would enjoy reading that. So that was what I tried to do, and I guess that's where I threw myself into it. I've never had any problems using the first person in my writing, but usually, you know, in more straightforward critical things, that's just a way of locating the argument. Here I made, in some moments, myself a character, myself looking, trying to understand, having conversations with people. And that was one of the pleasures. It also let me go to some interesting places. The James book took me repeatedly to Italy and to all these Civil War battlefields for Faulkner. So that was fun.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I understand what you're saying about narrative and story, and it is true that we read for stories, but you're selling yourself short some here because you are the story here. It's not just you as the first person.
Thank you.
It's your quest to understand not just this writer's take on history, but history itself.
Right.
That's what you did.
Okay. Here. Yeah.
So I would say, I just made some notes and I said that this is a very confident book. It's a very assertive book because it's about you and this text and history. It's not about theory in any way. So it's this breath of fresh air, to use a cliche, when it comes to literary studies. So one of the questions I have to ask you is, how do you locate your book, what you did in this book, in the context of literary studies as you understand them today?
Right. Well, I'm gonna answer another question, implicit question first, and then I'll try to answer that. One of the things that I said in my preface is that I wanted to try to understand Faulkner and the Civil War and the different moments of both of them as a way to understand our country now. And that understanding was I thought of myself writing not primarily as a scholar, but as a citizen, as an American citizen trying to understand the course of our nation's history. Now, obviously, to do that, I had to draw on all the scholarly abilities, whatever they are, that I have, the abilities as a researcher and as a writer and as a reader of fiction. And I used all those things to try to understand our past as a way to understand our present. And of course, the book, you know, published in the summer of 2020 turned out to be much more timely than I had ever imagined it was going to be. And the summer of George Floyd and the summer in which the Confederate memorials began to come down, the book turned out, it was more timely than I could have possibly known. As to where I situate myself in literary studies, it's of course a complicated question. I'm somebody who went to graduate school in English, when I decided to go to graduate school in English, the other thing I thought about doing was going to journalism school, and saw myself as a potential reporter or magazine writer or reviewer for newspapers, somebody working on the cultural or the arts desk at newspapers. I went to graduate school instead, but decided when I got into graduate school that I was going to try to do that too. So I started writing book reviews when I was in graduate school. I started writing book reviews for newspapers. This was the model of literary criticism I'd grown up with. I didn't know about scholarly journals when I was a kid. I didn't see a whole lot of them when I was an undergraduate. And the faculty members, the professors I knew of who were publishing things when I was an undergraduate, my teachers, they were publishing in the New York Times Book Review and places like that. And I thought that's what you were supposed to do. So I started trying to do that as soon as I got to graduate school, and I was fortunate. I made a couple of contacts through some of my old professors and started writing for sort of old fashioned literary quarterlies, places like, the Hudson Review, for example, not strictly scholarly journals, but little magazines that would publish criticism alongside fiction and poetry. And that was always my preferred way of publishing. I wasn't at all certain how this was going to play when it came time to look for a job or within the academy as a whole. I began writing book reviews for newspapers in the San Francisco Bay Area first, and then while I was still in graduate school for the Times Book Review. So I kept on doing those things, and meanwhile having, yes, to do some more traditional scholarly writing. I had to learn enough theory to get out of graduate school. But I was never happy with two things. One is with the language of theory, which seemed to me to have a kind of totalizing claim. You seemed to have to buy into whatever methodology you're using totally. And it didn't always seem to me as flexible as it might be. I thought, why can't we use theoretical observation, just quote it and use it for what it can give you at that moment in the same way we might quote from a critic like Lionel Trilling or other older critics. You know, just use them, use theoretical observations normally. And I think that's now what people do. But this is, I was in graduate school in the late 70s and early 80s, and when theory was ascendant. So I didn't like the totalizing claims of theoretical language. I also didn't like the way that language seemed basically to exclude anybody who hadn't gone to graduate school. I wanted to write for whatever kind of quote-unquote common reader there might be out there. I mean, the simplest way to put this is I wanted to write things my parents could read and enjoy, and so I wrote for newspapers. I did do some scholarly writing. I published books with university presses, but I think all the time I was doing that, my best writing was really in the reviews I was doing for the Times or for TLS. And not in my scholarly books. I think with the James book and the Faulkner book even more, that I managed to find a way to, I don't know, use everything I had to, and another way to put this is, I thought I can write a really, really good 2,000 word book review and keep people interested and say interesting things. Can I do that over 300 or 400 pages? Can I write with the same, I don't know, the same verve and the same energy and the same, you know, pull people along over that length? So I needed to find a way to try to do that. And the storytelling and the bits of travel writing and so on fed into that. And we're part of the way in which I tried to do that. I do feel that with these two books on James and on Faulkner, that I found a way to maximize whatever abilities I have, and also, you know, in effect to minimize the things that I don't do very well.
Let me jump in and ask you a question. Did you have to, or did you consciously make a decision at some time during the project that it was for a trade publisher rather than an academic press that you were aiming for?
I did. I thought that, you know, there was a chance to reach more readers. The James book, the James book was, I had an offer from both a trade press and a university press, and I didn't know the editor at the trade press in the way I did at the university press. So I emailed people I knew who'd published books with him, and they said, absolutely, go with him. And so I did. And in fact, I think I got a level of editorial attention that I had not seen before in terms of the shaping of individual chapters, the shaping of the narrative. Not things like the kinds of things you get from peer review. I had friends who, colleagues who read chapters and gave me that, but things like, there's too much detail here, or you've started too many chapters this way, or this is a place where you should slow down for pace. Here are the things that the reader doesn't know that they need to know. Characterize what this city was like at this moment. And my wonderful editor, Bob Weil at Liveright, is just a master at shaping a narrative, at helping an author shape a narrative. He was wonderful. Now Norton, if you manage to find a kind of sweet spot where you can appeal to both the scholarly audience and to a more general public, that's just a wonderful position to be in. And, you know, and I guess I seem to have done it with that. There are other people who do this.
When did your agent step into the picture? How you convinced Norton that this is the book they should publish?
Okay. So my agent, when I first had an agent, and he has since left that firm, was a man named Steve Wasserman, who had been the book editor at the LA Times, the book review editor at the LA Times, and I'd written for him. And he was going to work as an agent, and I asked if he would be interested in taking me on as a client and representing this book. And he said yes. So he read a couple of drafts of a proposal. We found ways to expand it to make it livelier. It got rejected a few times, and then revised in the light of those rejections. And then he managed to place, what he sold was not the book, not the finished book, but the proposal. Mm-hmm. And then I had to write the book. he's since left being an agent, and has gone back to being an editor. He was first at Yale University Press and now is an editor at a small press in Berkeley. And I'm represented by the one of the founding partners of that agency, Jill Nero. So I was getting an agent is hard, and I think it would have been almost impossible to place a book like mine with a trade press without an agent. So I was very fortunate in that.
A lot of people, when they read this book, are going to wonder about you and your reading habits. They're going to want to know just how well does he know Faulkner, because you took the most difficult writer to write about. He is, I mean, I'm a fairly sophisticated reader, and I struggle with his books, and you write actually quite a bit in your book about how difficult he is. Can you describe for me how well you, and I don't want you to be modest here, I just want you to tell me the facts, how well you know Faulkner, how many times you've read certain books, whether you've read them all, how often you've gone back to read them as a collection. Tell me about your relationship with Faulkner as a reader.
Okay, so, you know, there are some books I know much better than others. The second and third books of the Snope trilogies, The Town and The Mansion, I've read them once. I read them after reading everything else, so I knew the territory. And I knew I wasn't going to have much to say about them, so that once was enough. I don't know how many times I've read As I Lay Dying. I first read it the summer after I got out of college, and because I was teaching it at a prep school summer session, I think I probably read it three times by the end of the summer. And then I read it probably once I started teaching. I taught it almost annually in a course for first year students on how to read fiction. So I probably reread that book every year, every other year for 10, 15 years. I've read it a number of times since then through doing editorial work. Sound of the Fury and Absalom, it's the amount of, I've read them a lot. I don't think I could count up the number of times I've read both of those novels. I think I've probably taught The Sound of the Fury about 10 times. And once you've taught something once or twice, you don't reread it every year, but you review it every year. So I find myself going back more and more now to Light in August, which is the novel that I would now, that I didn't write a whole lot about it in the book, but I would like to write something about it someday. I've put a lot of time in reading Faulkner. And the Absalom is hard, and it's not airplane reading even for me. Some of his other books I could do on an airplane, but Absalom, no. The Sound and the Fury, the technically complicated stream of consciousness chapters, the one from the point of view of Benji Compson, who's mentally disabled, and of Quentin Compson, who's about to commit suicide. Those I can sit back in a comfortable chair and now read very happily, very smoothly. But it wasn't like that the first four or five times.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about Henry James.
Oh, okay.
How well do you know his shelf of books?
Well, again, with the exception of a few short stories, I've read everything. But I haven't read them all equally well or equally often. So again, Portrait of a Lady, I no idea how many times I've read it. Same with Daisy Miller, Washington Square. Golden Bowl a few times, The Ambassadors a few times. I'd like to reread The Golden Bowl, but there are other books that I like quite a lot that I've only read once, like The Tragic Muse or Roderick Hudson. Some of the James I've read most often are his critical essays, The Art of Fiction or the prefaces he wrote to various of his own novels. I like rereading his letters as well. Mm-hmm. James is a marvelous letter writer. Faulkner's a lousy letter writer. He barely wrote letters. He would sometimes just scribble a sentence or two on your letter and send it back to you. But James is a marvelous letter writer.
Another thing people are going to want to know about you is, why do you do this? Now, I'll disclose a little bit about myself. I've read Hamlet, say, 100 times. And every time I read it, I'm glad that I've read it that last time. So the 100th time, I still learn something that I didn't read or didn't know the first 99 times. Do you get that kind of satisfaction out of reading either Henry James or Faulkner?
I do, and out of reading Jane Austen and George Eliot as well.
So when the reader wants Dickens to know too. From you,
yeah,
what do you get out of these people, their novels? What do you say?
Well, there are a lot of different answers to that. One is pleasure. I think pleasure is underrated. Just the way those sentences make me shiver and sigh sometimes. The images make me, in Dickens, make me happy. In George Eliot, make me think. In Faulkner, I think so many of the images are troubling in a way that they're sort of overwhelming or sublime. One of the things I love about reading Faulkner is the rhythms of the sentences. When he gets his characters talking and telling stories to each other and telling lies to each other, I love the oral quality that gets into his novels as characters tell stories to each other. I love the way that he's able to pack six adjectives before a noun, often bleak ones, and that makes you shiver in a kind of wintry night way. It's not a shiver with pleasure, but it's a shiver where you know you're alive. Emily Dickinson, I think, said that you know you've read a poem of genius when you feel like the top of your head has been taken off, and you like it. I feel that way when I'm reading Faulkner sometimes, especially Absalom.
Okay. Now here's one last thing I wanted to ask you about. Edmund Wilson shows up in your book quite a few times. Not just talking about patriotic war, but Edmund Wilson, the critic. Get the idea that you think very highly of him, and you think that he had made a great contribution to American letters.
Well, I think he did. Wilson's Patriotic Gore is the book that taught us how to read the literature of the Civil War. Before that, people were saying something like, the Civil War produced no great novel. There's no War and Peace coming out of the Civil War. There's no Charterhouse of Parma. There's no great novel out of the Civil War. And what Wilson said basically was, you're looking in the wrong place. There's great writing about the war. It may not be novels, but there's great writing about the war. There's speeches, there's letters, there's historical writing, there are diaries, there are bits of memoir. There's great writing about the war. And in doing that, he not only made the Civil War, more available to us as a literary subject. I think he, and this would take a while to play out, and it's not just him, but I think he made us expand our notion of what counts as literature. So yes, letters and diaries, they count as literature. Memoirs, speeches, oratory, that's literature too. One of the interesting things is that this is where, curiously, Wilson would be very much in sync with the feminist criticism of the 70s and 80s, which says, look beyond your usual canons of novels and poems and plays. Look to other kinds of writing if we want to find significant literary expression. And so people started looking more at letters and diaries and so on. This is actually something Virginia Woolf knew and wrote about as well. And I think she and Wilson would both be surprised to find themselves in each other's company. But both of them are encouraging, you to look beyond the usual suspects for great writing. So I admire Wilson for that. And I also admire him for the way he combined quite a lot of critical rigor with an ability to make his subjects vivid and alive on the page. So I admire him as a writer. And in some ways, the sort of biographical sketches he does of the writers he works on, that's a model for me too.
Well, I just wanted to mention that some of the best writing in your book is when you're writing about Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs. You have a terrific section about that. I mean, he really seemed to have captured your imagination in his description of the war.
So. Yes. Yes.
All right.
You know, he does, and I would say Sherman's as well. Sherman's memoirs are worth reading as well. Sherman is a more high-strung, slightly crazy person than Grant is, but his memoirs are very much worth reading.
So what are you throwing yourself into next? What's the next project?
It's a completely different thing. And it's actually, it's in some ways more academic. I'm starting a book on the 19th century short story. This is another thing I've been teaching a class on. I seem not capable of settling down into one field and sticking with it. So the 19th century short story, and it will be a comparative study looking at a lot of European materials, Russian short stories, some French and German things, along with American writers. So I will have Hawthorne in there, and I'll also have Arthur Conan Doyle and Kipling, but along with Turgenev and Chekhov and Maupassant, and you know, it's big and unwieldy, and it's still taking shape, and it will be a few years from now.
Well, how do you get some travel out of that? You're going to have to go someplace, right?
I don't think I'm going to get much travel out of it, and unless I have to go look at some libraries in France to look at how newspapers and magazines in which some of these things were first published. But you know, unfortunately, I suspect I can do that probably in Cambridge. So not much travel there, and a lot more straightforward library work.
All right. Well, I look forward to that book because I'm going to read everything that you've written now that I've read this book. I have not read the Henry James book, and I plan to read it.
Thank you.
Probably next week. Well, you've been a terrific guest. You really have been terrific because you've answered all the questions I put to you. Some of them are fairly challenging. You've answered them very honestly, and I really appreciate that because I'm asking you about your life, really, about what makes you tick. And you told me.
This was fun, Bill. You know, this is fun.
Well, that's good. All right, so I'm going to stop the recording, and then you and I have to hold on for a few minutes, all right? So once again, Michael, thank you very much for doing this for the New Books Network.